This is the Education Gadfly Show.
My husband and I stayed up the other night, like midnight, watching the Thriller in Manila.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the original Education Gadfly and the Muhammad Ali of education reform, Checker Finn.
Bite like a butterfly, sting like an ant. How does that go?
And to be clear, you are still alive, so I don't want anybody to be confused by that. But
Thank you.
The boxing metaphor maybe doesn't work great, but it has been really fascinating to hear all the great obituaries for him over the last few days. You know, I don't have a lot of, I feel like I missed a lot of the history here. I wasn't old enough to actually experience it, but did you ever by chance get to meet him when you were in the White House or anything? Or how did that all go down? What did the Nixon administration think of Muhammad Ali?
I think they liked him better when he was Cassius Clay.
Okay, well, lots to talk about in Education Checker, even though it is now the summertime in much of the country. A few more weeks for my own sons in schools here in Montgomery County. But I am amazed that it does seem like most of the country is done. Some would blame standardized testing that the schools now front load their school year as much as possible. We're going to be back to school before you know it.
I just blame the fact that a lot of places didn't have air conditioning, so they decided to quit school in May.
I'm not sure if that's it or not.
This goes back a long way, calendars.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Clara, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Checker and Mike, what is your takeaway from the developing left-right schism in education reform? Are bipartisan coalitions still possible in today's polarized times?
So, Checker, you were away for a lot of this, sailing through the Panama Canal.
Yes.
But there was a big debate that has happened over the last couple of weeks, sparked by our own colleague, Robert Pendicio.
Yes.
About whether or not the education reform movement is becoming unfriendly to conservatives. That yes. It has shifted leftward very much so, and that it's making many of us that are on the center right feel like perhaps we're not a part of the big tent anymore. I'm curious about what your take is on this. And also just historically, have we seen this before? Have we seen these tensions over the years in education reform?
I think you'd have to go back a ways. I mean, I think the big story of the last 25 years has been a fair degree of consensus across left and right on much of education reform, not everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly not vouchers, for example, at one end, which were only an issue of the right. And certainly not compulsory busing, which let's say was only an issue of the left, but on standards, testing, accountability, and charters, teacher quality, there's been a pretty good convergence. That may well be deteriorating. And if it is, it would take us back to probably the early 60s before ESCA, when there really was a lot of partisan sparring about whether for example, the federal government should do anything at all in education.
Right. But that's not to say, Checker, that there have not been some family feuds before within, you know, that we've all been exactly on the same page. I mean, that say a Jeannie Allen on the right and a Katie Haycock on the left have always agreed on everything over the last 20 years.
No, that's right. They probably disagreed on more than they've agreed on. But there's been a kind of a substantial center or at least substantial area of overlap, big enough to get stuff done.
Yeah,
I mean, just remember, NCLB was bipartisan and ESSA was bipartisan. Is it because of agreement or simply compromise? And I'm beginning to think the difference is an important one.
So what's left? I mean, do we still have any areas of agreement, particularly as the country's become more polarized, as a few years ago, the right became stronger and pulled away the center on the Republican side. Now you have the sense that the left is stronger within the Democratic Party. Is there a center left? And if so, what do we agree on? Anything?
Maybe charter schools, maybe at least the no excuses version of charter schools that want poor kids to go to college in larger numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure much else right at this moment. I think if we're picturing left and right as, let's say, Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz, I'm not sure there's a lot of overlap in terms of policy objectives.
Yeah. And look, even the no excuses charter schools are coming under attack from some people who would claim that they are reformers. I'm not sure that makes sense to me, but people saying, well, Eva Moskowitz is suspending too many kids, or we're not so sure about this approach to school culture and discipline within any of the no excuses schools. I mean, even pushing again, as you say, if there's anything that we all agree on, it seems to be KIPP, right?
Yes.
We, the left, the center left and the center right loves KIPP and schools like it. If that's no longer the case, then I don't see that we've got anything left.
Yeah, there is a critique from the left about no excuses schools, that they are turning out little robots, that they are intolerant of differences, that they are intolerant of kids with special needs and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a critique.
But those folks in the past were not a part of the reform movement. And now it seems like some are.
So, I don't know what else I'd cite right at this moment as an example of reform consensus. So I'm thinking about it, looking for some more examples.
All right. Topic number two.
Checker, you've been working on a series of articles about charter schools drawn from your forthcoming book. Recently, you argue that we need more than just no excuses charter schools for poor kids. Mm-hmm. Why?
What a segue. I love it.
Perfect segue. Yeah. First of all, Brandon Wright and Bruno Mano and I do indeed have a forthcoming book coming out about 25 years of charter schools and what have we learned and what does the future hold? And one of our conclusions is that the future should not just be a linear extension of the past, that chartering is a much more flexible and diverse instrument that can meet many more needs in society. In addition to helping poor kids get to college. Mm-hmm. The No Excuses Schools I'm a huge admirer of, and we should do more of them and do them better. But chartering can do a lot more than that. What about charter schools for gifted kids? What about charter schools for kids pursuing a CTE career orientation rather than college? What about charter schools for kids that want to do music? I think there are a lot of other possibilities here, and as well as some very nifty governance and structural changes that the chartering opportunity creates, not just schools for kids.
So, and do you think that idea is controversial to say that, hey, you know, we already have some states that have middle-class charter schools and suburban charter schools and progressive charter schools? I mean, is that, so you're basically saying that every state should have a broader mix of schools than just the urban charter or the urban no excuses charter?
I'm certainly saying that funders and policymakers should be thinking more broadly than let's have more KIPP schools. Yes, let's have more KIPP schools. But the fact that there are middle class charter schools in Utah and Colorado doesn't mean there are any in Ohio. The fact that something happens in one place doesn't mean that it's part of the charter movement. You can find examples of everything in the charter movement, but it doesn't mean that you can find nearly enough of them in nearly enough places for nearly enough kids.
Yeah, no. And look, it is interesting that there seems to be various fields in education that start out about something else. Say people are pushing the idea of blended learning, for example, and they soon discover that it can be really hard to make that happen in traditional public school systems. And so lo and behold, you want to really try something that's innovative and that's outside the box. You try it in a charter school.
And chartering is this flexible instrument that allows things to be done outside the box. And I think the risk here is that it's going to end up creating its own box. It needs to reach outside of the box it has created or the boxes that it has created. Funders have helped to do that. So policymakers, I think we ought to be thinking more broadly.
Okay, Clara, topic number three.
Montgomery County in Maryland is trying to diversify its pool of gifted and talented students and its selective magnet schools. Should admissions criteria take a student's race into consideration? What if that results in fewer Asian American students in these programs?
Checker. So your last book was about gifted education in America and around the world. Here we are in our own local school district. This is where my son goes to school.
And where I live.
And where you live. And they are concerned that when you look at the gifted and talented programs in Montgomery County, or you look at their selective magnet schools, lo and behold, they do not represent the diversity of the county. This is a huge 150,000 kid district, increasingly diverse, a lot of low income kids, lots of Latino and African American kids. And yet the gifted and talented programs in the magnet schools are overwhelmingly white and Asian. And I would say, look, if anything, more Asian than white. And so they're now looking at some ways to maybe take race into consideration. And I've been following some of this on the local blogs and listservs. And I would say a lot of parents of gifted and talented kids are concerned. And I think it's safe to say it's particularly among Asian American parents are freaked out that their kids might be excluded from these programs based on their race.
As they are freaked out about their kids being excluded from Ivy League universities.
Exactly.
For the exact same reason that, you know, Yale and Princeton and Brown are bending over backwards to attract mm-hmm. more kids who are not Asian, because if they did it on a pure meritocratic right. and motivational basis, they would end up awash in Asian kids.
I mean, 100 years ago, universities did this with quotas for Jewish kids.
Absolutely.
Right.
I believe that gifted and talented programs in particular need to do a much better job of outreach and recruitment and preparation and encouragement. But I don't really believe that anything ought to be race-based mm-hmm. in American society. I really do believe in a colorblind society in which you do your damnedest to get kids from all over the place to apply and be qualified.
Yep.
But then you admit them on the basis of their qualifications, not their color.
Well, maybe there's a compromise here, which is to say, look, let's keep the high schools, which are these selective magnet high schools, keep them colorblind, right? But at the earlier ages, let's make sure that every single elementary school in Montgomery County has a robust gifted and talented program, including those elementary schools that serve a high percentage of poor kids and minority kids, and have, you know, make sure that the universal screening that Montgomery County does do and that you have called for around the country, that the universal screening ends up attracting, you know, a diverse group of kids. And again, if you have a pipeline coming from the county's poorer and more diverse schools, and you make sure that those schools, you know, go out of their way to attract, you know, to build a cohort of kids who could compete to get into those magnet schools on their own merits, that maybe that's a way to solve the problem.
That's fine. I'm all for that. And I'm all for kindergarten readiness so that when the kids get to kindergarten, they're ready to learn. Mm-hmm. And if they need 2 years in kindergarten before they are ready for the gifted first grade program, that's fine too. Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm completely in line with that. And as you just alluded, the universal screening such that everybody has a shot at the gifted program is, I think, very important. You don't just want the kids with pushy parents like you to be qualified for gifted, to be candidates for gifted programs. Mm-hmm. And you certainly don't want a district that only puts gifted programs in schools with pushy parents.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
Okay. We have consensus. At least on that
something.
One thing.
At least
on
between something. Two of us.
Yes, indeed. All right. That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Checker and I were speaking about Muhammad Ali's passing earlier. You have been really riveted
really
by this.
Really love Muhammad Ali. My grandmother was a huge Muhammad Ali fan.
Yeah.
And I remember her just yelling at the TV with the Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali fights. So my husband and I stayed up the other night till like midnight watching the Thrilla in Manila. And with Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali, if you've not seen that fight, you must go on YouTube and watch it. It's just riveting. I mean, I love the Rocky movies. And it was like a real Rocky movie. Both of them just leaving it all out in the mat. Yeah. Joe Frazier's eyeballs are both like completely puffed up and shut, but he doesn't want to stop fighting. And they had to stop the fight. And both men at the end of the fight said, you know, we just have the utmost respect for each other. You know, they both, we just, you know, try to kill each other, but we both bring out the best fighting expertise in one another. So.
Wow. It's impressive.
I'm excited.
She does boxing. I do out of the box.
There you have it.
Okay, good. All right, Amber, what you got for us?
I got a new evaluation of CDC. I just figured I'd do a backyard study here, right? So this is according to the report, the nation's
Center for Disease Control?
SEED.
Oh, SEED.
The boarding school.
SEED. I thought you said CDC.
Do you know what I meant, Checker?
No, I also thought you meant the Center for
Disease Control. All right, the school, SEED.
SEED school.
D.C.
Right. It is, according to the report, the nation's first urban public college preparatory boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's located in Southeast Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. It serves about 346 through 12th graders. Most of them are African-American, low-performing, economically disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. And the school's operating assumption is that breaking the cycle of poverty requires a holistic intervention that provides students with a safe place to live, regular healthy meals, caring adults, and resources, library, extracurricular activities, and so on that middle and high-income communities take for granted. Mm-hmm. Okay? So analysts from MDRC analyzed how the SEED program is run and whether being offered a SEED slot impacted student outcomes. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they used DC's annual admissions lottery. They identified two comparable groups. So this is a gold study design here. Mm-hmm. Those who applied to SEED and were randomly selected to be offered the slot, and applicants who applied and didn't get the slot.
okay, about 766 kids between the years of 2006 and 2011. All right, CDC, important little factoid, open to any student who resides in Washington. Okay, so there are no admissions requirements per se because of all the, you know, regulations and rules around DC. So 80% of the lottery winners were eligible for free and reduced price lunch. So not 100%, 80%. And just under, this is kind of high, under just under 50% scored at or above proficient on the district reading exam. So that's not terrible. I mean, it's not good, but as for the program itself, I won't go into this too much, but it's rich in academic support, social skills instruction. They have lots of college counseling. And for middle schools in particular, those kids have very highly regimented and scheduled dates. They interviewed the kids and they were like, oh, we're so busy. They look at the effects finally on both the sixth and seventh grade cohorts. Okay. Only a small percentage, only about 200 have had time to actually graduate. So those graduation findings are for a small group. Finding number one, on average, being offered a slot increased academic achievement in math by about 0.25 standard deviations compared to lottery losers in the first year. By the second year, that math impact had grown, and it was about the equivalent of 1.5 years of typical growth. Okay, that's pretty good. Reading impacts were negligible in year one, but year two, they got to about the equivalent of 1 year of growth by year two. Okay. As for longer-term impacts, the offer of seat attendance had no effect on students' probability of graduating in 4 years.
Graduating high school.
High school in 4 years. Analysts point out, however, that those who lost the lottery attended a variety of traditional and charter schools in D.C., and that D.C. has a fairly innovative choice climate. So these lottery, they were kind of saying like the lottery losers, the comparison group wasn't too shabby, right, because of their choices. They also found that seed kids spent more time on homework, yet, this is interesting, they indicated more frequent risky behaviors than the comparison group. Like
when?
Skipping school. I'm like, how do they have time to skip school when there's adults everywhere?
And when they live there.
All right. And arguing with parents. And they also reported lower measures of grit or perseverance. But this reminded me of the KIPP study where everything's relative, right?
Right.
You don't think
reference
bias. Yeah, yeah, reference bias. Good, Mike.
Boom.
So these are mixed findings. And so they go on and try to say, what do we make of these mixed findings? One thing, and this is pretty important, half of the original group at the school was no longer there by 12th grade.
Wow.
Half. So it raises the question of whether the school might have been more impactful if they are able to keep these kids all the way from 6th to 12th grade, which they don't.
Remind us again how much the school costs.
It said twice the amount of a traditional public education. They actually didn't give a dollar amount, but.
Which
twice
in D.C. means
so
it's nearing $40,000, north of $30,000 per kid, which is what I've always understood.
Wow. I mean, I have to say, I love the seed people and I'm friends with Raj. Vinakota helped start it. But yikes, this sounds like pretty disappointing findings for that huge investment. I mean, always been the question is, that's a lot of money. And do you get the return on investment versus a KIPP that might be getting just as strong results at a lot less of the cost because the kids aren't living there too.
Yeah. I'd like to know a little more about who goes there because while it may be officially open, being a residential school starting in sixth grade, I've always understood that kids from really, really, really troubled home situations is who ends up in the seed school. Essentially kids who need an alternative place to live and an alternative group of adults. Now, maybe that's not true, and that would disabuse me of a lot.
Yeah, it sounds like that's not always true.
Right, because I mean, they're so relatively high performing on those tests on the front end.
Less than 50%. I mean, I'm at a charter school, on a charter school board now where we have 7%.
All right, but that's after Park. So those test scores way back when were at an easier test. Right?
Well, this is just, this is the CAS,
Okay. But still, right, it looks like these kids on the front end were relatively high performing.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a big difference if it's a publicly financed handover for kids who are relatively well off, so to speak, as opposed to the neediest of all.
Or, let's say these are working class kids in D.C., versus, as you say, kids whose families are completely dysfunctional and they need foster care placement.
That was how I thought it was.
Yeah, and I don't think that's entirely true. And that's what they say in the report, that in other places where they have enrollment criteria that they're recruiting just the type of kid you're talking
maybe
about.
Maybe the Maryland school is more like that.
Yeah, that's right.
There are only two others right now besides D.C.
Yeah.
Maryland and I believe Florida.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So,
okay.
They just said, you know, we're going to, I guess they have a statement. They're going to work harder on retention, recruitment. And there's even some indications that they could, you know, amp it up on the academic side. Mm-hmm. So,
You know, it does strike me that in a place like DC, and I guess there's a handful of other cities now with these lotteries that are centralized, you have a lot of possibilities for these gold standard studies at the school level.
Yes, I see where this is going. I
like the idea.
More work for Amber.
More work for Amber. Let's look at, I mean, how does the KIPP school do here?
Do you realize
in DC?
How much MDRC you probably got for this study? I mean, I don't know.
But. I'm sure there are listeners out there who would love to give us a lot of money us to be able to answer those questions as well. All right, good. Thank you, Amber, for that. Thanks. And as always, Checker, great to have you with us. Till next week.
I'm Checker Finn.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.